Hello, this is Jonathan Shaler, your host on WGTD's Education Matters. I'm very pleased to introduce you to my guest today. It's Mr. Scott Jackson of Shakespeare at Notre Dame. He is the executive artistic director since its founding. That's Shakespeare at Notre Dame. The position was created in 2007, and he provides oversight for the many Shakespeare-related programs housed at the University of Notre Dame, with a particular focus on engaging the local community through the works of William Shakespeare. For those in our listening audience who know me, it's probably not a surprise that I'm introducing somebody like Scott Jackson as a guest because of my own interests. Scott and I have crossed paths many times, primarily through the Shakespeare in Prisons Network, which I'm sure we'll be talking about at one point or another during our conversation. Let me tell you more about Scott. He previously served as executive director for the Fairbanks Shakespeare Theater in Fairbanks, Alaska, which sounds completely awesome, doing outdoor Shakespeare productions staged under the midnight sun, and also not just in Alaska, but around the globe. And then from 2000 to 2003, he was the business and legal affairs coordinator for an independent television and film production company called Brighter Pictures. He holds a dual BA in theater and history from Indiana University, Bloomington, and MFA, with distinction in actor training and coaching from the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama at the University of London. And he's a certified Kundalini yoga teacher under acclaimed practitioner Maya Fiennes. Did I pronounce her name correctly?
Fiennes.
Fiennes. And he's produced, directed, and performed in over 175 theatrical productions. We're going to get some down deep into some of his specific teaching practices, so I'll be launching into those questions very shortly. But first, I just wanted to say hello, Scott.
Hi, Jonathan. It's great to
How
be
are
with you?
You.
Oh, things are good. Things are good.
Yeah.
You know, just coming on the tail end of our summer season here, we just closed a fabulous production of As You Like It with the Notre Dame Shakespeare Festival, and just into the pre-launch of a national tour of Twelfth Night by actors from the London stage, both resident companies here at Shakespeare at Notre Dame.
What an amazing situation you're in there, and what wonderful work that you're having the opportunity to do. So, I mean, I would ask you what a typical day is like, but there probably isn't a typical day in your position, is there?
I think there's an arc to what it is I do, is, you know, from that producer mindset. I mean, I guess I should qualify myself as kind of a hybrid theater maker, right? I produce, I act, I direct, I teach. I'm an activist. And someone who's very, very invested in the University of Notre Dame's overall social justice mission, which is to see the university functioning as a force for good in the world. So as a non-Catholic myself, it's still something that speaks to my heart, and that guides so much of my community-based work in this field, of which you are so instrumental in forming, this field that's becoming known as applied Shakespeare, where we take Shakespeare out of the confines of what the traditional audience actor relationship and place it squarely in community settings, and give voice to populations that we would never think would have a connection to Shakespeare. Boy, they do it beautifully.
Fantastic. Now, I want to get right into some of your specific teaching practices. I mean, this world that you inhabit and that you're talking about, and the many amazing things that you do, just are mind-boggling. But rather than just clicking off the list, I'd maybe like to dip in here and there.
Yeah.
So you spent about 4 weeks teaching in Prague, Czechoslovakia, this summer. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I did. Wow, I'm blessed. I've been on the faculty of the Prague Shakespeare Company Summer Shakespeare Intensive since 2018, right? COVID notwithstanding, we went online for two summers, right? But I've spent a good month to 6 weeks in Prague each summer since 2018. And this last summer, you know, I was there for 4 weeks. I was teaching yoga and a kind of a specialized convergence of mindfulness practice with actor training that I've developed called Foundationing, that seeks to reinvent or reimagine how students enter the acting conservatory, right? By placing mental well-being, neurophysiological awareness, personal agency, and the ethics of care at the very foundation of an actor's training. Because I know I was taught one way that I'm still kind of trying to get over at age 50. And I know I'm not alone, right? So using that experience to actually upset some of those paradigms that can be harmful to developing students as they enter something where the instrument is their body and their emotional life, right?
Yes.
So I'm teaching that in Prague, as well as I teach kind of a deconstructed Meisner technique that I call perspectiving, because I believe that Meisner was just after a certain presence of self and of mind in performance, but he just didn't have the language or the awareness of how to go about that. So he pushed people into some pretty nasty, dangerous places, right? There's definitely some nuggets of gold in that technique, but there's also a lot of other things, let's call them that I think can be excised from that approach. So, and then additionally, I just played Duke Theseus in Two Noble Kinsmen, which is a play you never get the opportunity
to
perform on the Estates Theater stage in Prague, which has the distinction of having this little plaque right in the middle of the stage that says, "Here stood Mozart at the world premiere of Don Giovanni in 1787.
Come on.
You're playing this house with five galleries high. I mean, it's glorious. What an incredible experience I had there too. Yeah.
That is wonderful. So I'm going to ask you to go granular with me a little bit on some of this. So let's start with foundationing. Could you name one, or more, but, so let's start with one, maybe traditional theater practice, theater training practice, which you definitely don't do as part of foundationing, or that you possibly see as harmful, if you can name one. And then on the other hand, something that is part of foundationing that you think is unique and essential and might even be surprising to somebody who thinks that they're a pretty decent theater acting teacher, theater director, and that they do breathing exercises and gentle warm-ups and everything. But you do something more. I'm putting pressure on you, Scott, but I just...
I got you. Yeah, okay. This is an easy one for me.
All right.
First off, I should preface this by saying, this approach to acting was born in the prison classroom. Something that you and I are both keenly aware that we are working with individuals who are traumatized, as most of us are to some degree, but living in a traumatizing environment as well. So what am I asking in terms of a certain investment of self in acting, a certain vulnerability that they aren't allowed to explore outside that classroom, right? Mm-hmm. So that, first off, like teaching in that environment led me to start questioning my own approach. Mm. And what was I after? Was I after this exemplary product, as it were, in terms of their engagement with Shakespeare or their talent as an actor? Or was I looking for something else? Mm-hmm. And that led me to this priority of allowing a gentle re-engagement with capital S self, which is something that these guys, right, because I'm working in men's facilities, something that these guys, that kernel of self has been compromised in many cases for these guys, and they're also wearing this protective layer almost of concrete that they have to, just by sheer survival, carry with them each moment that they're inside the facility, right? So what does it look like to give them an opportunity to set down that load, to sit and breathe with a fullness that most of us still, just who are on the outside, aren't breathing with that fullness of self, and what the breath can do in terms of resetting our nervous system. mm-hmm. right? This is ancient technology. We're talking sure. about pranayama. This goes back 5,000 years, forgotten technology.
Sure.
And so anyway, that was kind of the genesis mm. of where this technique comes from.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer the first part of your question, what is something I don't do
mm-hmm.
and something I actively try to push away from the actor training arena? That's the method,
mm.
right? This bastardization of Stanislavski's system, you know, Konstantin Stanislavski being mm-hmm. the grandfather, the great grandfather of Western acting technique and thought, mm-hmm. right? That system got misrepresented in the, you know, the 30s to the 50s here in America. There were a couple mm-hmm. different schools, Sanford Meisner being one of them, Lee Strasberg being another, who believed, mm-hmm. oh, it requires this investment of your own emotional inventory of all of these things, this sense memory. I remember when my dog died, and I'm going to bring that out on stage, which is a terribly harmful approach, right? Mm-hmm. So I make that very visible to my students that that's not acting, right? Mm-hmm. That's just re-traumatizing people on stage for the benefit of the theater that's producing it, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very much aware of like that tradition, and I'm trying to cut the bottom right out of that. You okay. know, Stanislavski was all about the as if.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as if I'm in that situation. Not that I have to dig deep inside and be like, where in my life
mm-hmm.
can I connect to that? Mm-hmm. You know? The other thing that I discovered about Stanislavski while I was in grad school was that every, you know, in the first iterations of the Moscow Art Theater, his theater there in the late 1800s, they started every day with pranayama and with hatha yoga.
Really?
This is something that was censored by the Soviets because it was mysticism. And it was something that was censored by the Americans because they thought it was, again, mysticism, and we're all Freudian here. And that Freudian lens led us to things like the method, right? Turning the lens inward and working with what we have in terms of our emotional palette and experience, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm very much trying to bring back the tradition of connection to the breath,
mm-hmm.
looseness and fluidity in the body,
yes.
and looking at ourselves, talk about granular, at the very base level that we are. If we buy into string theory, we're a light vibrating until some miracle happens and we become solid matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that trauma, being an embodied response to stress and requiring a physicalized regimen to mm-hmm. release that, mm-hmm. that physicalized response, if we look at it at that very basis subatomic level,
mm-hmm.
we're doing with mindfulness practice, with pranayama, with kriya, which is another word for action, which is another yogic technique,
mm-hmm.
we are creating space at that cellular level back mm-hmm. in the body,
mm-hmm.
and allowing for a certain reemergence of self, a reemergence of constriction from the mm-hmm. body that allows us to be right here and now, just like we are, mm-hmm. Present and available.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's the basis of foundationing.
Okay.
So I could say one of the principles in that I found mm-hmm. extremely impactful is, as a former voice major, I started undergrad as a voice major. I got hyper aware and insecure of my vocal technique, and it caused constriction in my larynx. I actually lost my first tenor range because of this habitual mm-hmm. tension. They became invisible to me. One of the modalities of Kundalini yoga specifically is mantra and chanting,
mm.
which allows a certain openness of the voice and a projection of the voice at a vibrational level. Mm-hmm. It's not about singing a song. It's about pushing vibration through the makeup, the physiology of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an incredibly impactful moment about 150 days into my practice. I'm now 1600 and I think today's 1642 days into this practice of daily practice. About 150 days in, my larynx dropped, And I just started to weep because there had been so much pressure built up here in my throat that I wasn't even aware of, but this practice allowed a release of it.
Wow.
And that lesson that I learned through practice has become, you know, part and parcel of this pedagogical approach in the classroom. Because I don't think you could really fully inhabit the present moment without that kind of release, without that release of constriction in the body.
Sure. So I'm wondering about the liminal space, to sound trendy, or the connective tissue is another metaphor I could use, between those kinds of practices, the breathing, the relaxation, the movement, the yoga, and the technical requirements of acting Shakespeare, you know, which involve all kinds of challenges. Now, I know, you know, just to mention a couple of practitioners that who we're familiar with, Stefan Wolfart, Wolfort, who does, you know, his Decruit method with returning veterans, and then also working with veterans, Feast of Crispian in Milwaukee, Nancy Smith Watson and Bill Watson. I know that Nancy and Bill, for example, use this, some variation of this technique from Shakespeare and Company, feeding and dropping.
Yeah.
Dropping in and feeding. Do you do something like that as the bridge, or do you have other ways of bridging between the very open kind of dropping into self and breathing and moving, and then here's the text?
Yeah. Yeah, 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 I do. There is a liminal space between, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The two are not obvious brethren.
Right.
Because I wouldn't even say they're cousins. They're like familial, like brother and sister. That sort of looseness, as it were, that flexibility, that nimbleness in being present allows for a certain engagement in, and again, looking at this from the prison classroom lens, a certain awareness that develops through taking that practice and extending it into what is it to be acting? You know, what are the mechanics of acting? And I teach it as it's both a craft and an art, right? So the craft of acting is, if you're weaving a basket, It's gotta hold the 4 pounds of apples that you need to carry, right? So the first thing first is we have to provide an analytical tool that allows us to build a sturdy basket, right? And that's scene analysis from an actor's mindset, right? And I use Robert Cohen's approach, which is GOAT, goal, obstacle, tactic, and expectation. So what's this character's goal? What's standing in their way? And then most importantly, and here's where the art comes in, how are they going about getting past that obstacle to achieve their goal, right? So those are tactics. Those are different doorways that we can enter and then trust the journey that Shakespeare's laid out for us. But we got to walk through a certain doorway, make a choice, not a decision, right? We're not murdering the other options that exist. We're just making a choice. I'm choosing strawberry ice cream today. Tomorrow I'm choosing chocolate. Tomorrow I'm choosing vanilla, right? So all the options still exist as an actor. I don't have to marry myself to one of them. So that's the craft that undergirds it. Then you start, as you get competent at weaving that basket and the burden it must carry, then you start to be like, you know, I'm going to weave in some color, or I'm going to weave in this specific pattern. And then it's artistic. You start to craft the art. And that's what tactical choices really do. And so Shakespeare, using Shakespeare as the vehicle for this then, since Shakespeare, especially Shakespeare written in verse as opposed to prose, right? Shakespeare written in verse gives this a certain metrical direction. You know, Shakespeare's written in iambic pentameter, di-dop, 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 di-dom, right? And different characters, I mean, the genius of Shakespeare is that direction of character is often written in that metrical verse. So Romeo, when he first sees Juliet, his response, you know, above, I should say, in the famous quote-unquote balcony scene, which isn't a balcony scene, it's a window scene, whatever, His response is, but soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. It's this teenage boy, you know, infatuated. Yeah, and his heart is racing, and you mm-hmm. hear it in the meter. Mm-hmm. And then you compare that to someone like Macbeth at the very end, after he finds out that Lady M has died. His line is, should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, etc., etc., right? His heart is stopping. He's slowing down. He's like on his way to dying.
That's a great contrast, yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my approach is about allowing an actor to open and be in the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
Understand what a character's motivation, what their goal is in a moment, mm-hmm. what's standing in their way, and giving them the toolkit of tactics. Like, here are the options. Try, mm-hmm. you know, try walking through this tactical doorway to negotiate, mm-hmm. or to connive, or to flatter, or to mm-hmm. manipulate, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
And then just trusting that by walking through that doorway, the text is going to support that choice. And you're going to find a discovery along yes. the way, which to me, watching discoveries happen in the present moment is what excites me about acting.
Yes. Right? Now I want to go a little deeper with you and share okay. something from my side of working with Shakespeare on the inside and just have a little back and forth. I love what you're saying so far, and it resonates very strongly. And I love the attention to language almost, for me, it feels like music and the same kind of attentiveness we would give to our to singing something fully and with care. But I just also want to mention that this is WGTD Radio, and our audience is listening to Education Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, and we are speaking to the Executive Artistic Director of Shakespeare at Notre Dame, Scott Jackson, and it is a treat. So let's keep going. So, Scott, yeah, do you like Scott Kaiser's method? I don't know if you've ever run into that or worked with it, but it's he calls it orchestrating Shakespeare, and he starts with the speech measure, then goes to operative words, focal points, images, spoken subtext, physical actions, psychological actions, and then kind of weaving it all together. And it's not a bad method. It's a pretty good way of covering all your bases, because you know it's very important, right, for an actor to know where's your focus, where are you looking, who or what are you attending to, whether it's on stage or off stage, or is it God or the heavens, what is it, you know.
I buy into especially operatives.
Operatives? You're very big on operatives?
Yeah. I feel that in terms of an approach, as you start to familiarize your embody the text, as it were, memorize the text, there's a certain inevitable emotional connection that you have to the initial memorization that you kind of have to knock out of yourself.
Huh.
So that something like, so may the outward shows be least themselves, suddenly becomes, some of the outward shows be least themselves, the world is still deceived with ornament, there is no vice so simple, but assumes a mark of virtue in his outward parts. So that I can then apply whatever tactical choice I want onto basically a blank canvas of that text. Operatives help me to decide, or to choose, not to decide, to choose what is the most important word in that line. To be or not to be, that is the question.
Right.
Be or not to be, that is the question. To be or not to be, that is the question, right? That helps to craft a certain journey through.
Mm.
Now, the rest of what was being, you know, Scott Kaiser's method, I'm sure mm-hmm. that works for others. Well, you know, Shakespeare didn't have any of that.
Right.
So it took me about 20 years into my career to be like, keep it simple, stupid.
Yep.
To walk back from technique a bit, to trust that there was a certain embodied awareness and approach to the technique, or to, mm-hmm. to Shakespeare itself, mm-hmm. that was in and of itself technique,
mm-hmm.
so that I could just be open to the discovery of these lines.
Discovery.
If I'm supplanting imagery in my head,
mm-hmm.
there's a certain prefabrication that is not necessarily reimagining or reinventing the monologue, as it were, in this moment. Yes. It's almost like we're trying to recreate what I did yesterday.
Yes.
And so for me, I've tried, because as somebody who is a bit OCD at the very, cellular level of myself, I have to discern when I'm getting caught into patterns and then consciously break free of those patterns so that I can be in service to the audience in front of me in this moment. Right. Mm-hmm. And I can't hit a home run every time I'm at bat, but man, I'm going to make sure there's some RBIs. I'm going to make sure that I'm setting this up,
It sounds like, and it feels like to me, I don't know if you would agree, that there's this kind of sweet spot, which is you've prepared, you've worked with the text, you've developed a sense of what you are seeing, because this idea of image is not so much a prefabricated kind of thing, but more the question, what are you seeing or who are you seeing? So when Gertrude is describing Ophelia's death, she is seeing that movie again. So where's the screen? Where is she seeing it? And what does it look like to her? I mean, it's in the words, but still to actually be seeing what you're seeing is something. I'm going kind of around the block here, but what I wanted to get back to with you is it feels like there's all of this this technique, which emerges gradually and in the moment and with the reality of the actors on the stage and with attentiveness and sensitivity to what the actor is actually discovering themselves. But by the time you get to performance, you've got all of that harvested or in the bank, and yet it's happening for the first time, right? What do you say about that?
Oh, that's great. That's a great question. I love that you asked me that. I've got a great metaphor for this.
Uh-huh.
First off, I believe, rehearsal obviously is preparation for performance. And I believe in tracking. So what I mean by tracking is, okay, act one, scene one, I come out stage right, and I walk to this table, and I pick up this prop, I say these lines, I hand the prop to this other actor, and then I walk out this door, upstage left or something. And then I walk down into the dressing room, I change my costume, I have a drink of water, I walk back up to upstage left, and I wait for my cue to walk in. All of that is part of the track of the show. And I'll mix this metaphor even further, right? So what happens through repetition is that I am training my body to know where it is at all times so that I can free my mind. So I know that my body's going to take me upstage left, and I'm going to walk through that door, and I'm going to do the things I need to do. And I compare it to those cars that you drive at like Disneyland.
Yes.
And you're like, I'm driving. And then you get a little too far to the left, and then there's a guardrail that keeps you on track. But you feel I'm in control, and I am free to be present and to make different choices in this moment. Nice. But that repetition of rehearsal is going to keep me from veering off into the pond over to the right. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's a level of guidance that keeps me free, but in the world of the play. So, that's how I view rehearsal. Nice. Not as marrying myself to, this is the way I say these lines, and I got to just find it that way every time. I release myself from that pressure, let my body be in control of all the mechanics, and then I can just meet the moment of performance head on and respond to what's in front of me.
That's fantastic. And something you said earlier that I don't want to be lost, because this is for me as much as for the audience, about the way you work with text with your actors. I heard three steps. There's their initial sense of where the emphasis falls. It was in our discussion of operative words. The emphasis just comes out a certain way when they first read it. Use the word so. And So you get them to just get the words flat, kind of. There's a second step, which is just get the words out flat. I don't know if you have a way of doing that. Just go to zero. And then
repetition,
take a choice.
You're so bored with it.
Repetition and boredom.
It's a choreography of the tongue, right? I think of it like get the emotional connection out. And yeah. It's like if I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic of Michigan, right? Yeah. It's just there. It's part of me.
Somatic. And then the third step is making choices. We're experimenting with choices.
Yeah.
So you said that you use some Meisner-derived kind of approaches or techniques, and I would love to hear about one or two of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we look at, Meisner starts with something called repetition. And this can be a very traumatizing activity, I think, as an actor, because there's this constriction that happens. You're two actors that are sitting in chairs, generally facing one another, making hardcore eye contact. Make an observation. And I'll give you an example of how this can be harmful. The first time I taught repetition formally in a college classroom, I brought two guys up. Well, they volunteered. They came up. They sat down in the chairs. One of them, a terribly good-looking guy, but he happened to have a kind of a misshapen ear, and so I have him sit down and I'm like, okay, close your eyes, feet on the ground, hands on your knees, deep breathing, open your eyes. Make a physical observation about your partner. Your ear is messed up was the first thing that came out of his partner's mouth. And I went, man,
wow,
there's gotta be a different way. And so I still believe in the power of being able to observe and not self-censor. But I also believe that there was a certain toxic masculinity in the days that Meisner was teaching this. Like, I'm a better actor than you. It was almost like an ingrained assumption that it was some sort of competitive battle between these two people. Well, I found if you undergird that process with mindfulness, with agency, and God forbid, love, that the observations that come out are just like, your hair is beautiful. That color's incredible.
Yes.
Your eyes are so alive.
Yes.
Things like that,
beautiful.
It just naturally filters over into the positive and away from the negative.
So for those of our listeners who may, that's beautiful. For those of our listeners who are not familiar with just with this very basic technique of repetition, could you just describe what it is?
Yeah, it's an unscripted, quote unquote, encounter, I think, with another person. And the first step of it generally is looking at your partner. Say, I'm looking at Jonathan right now. I know you can't see, but I'm like, you're wearing a blue shirt. His response then would be,
I'm wearing a blue shirt.
You're wearing a blue shirt. I'm wearing a blue shirt. Back and forth until one of us has a different observation. You have a goatee, right?
I have a goatee.
It shifts. And then as you become comfortable making the physical observation, you start to then branch into emotional observation. Like you're listening to me.
Or
you're puzzled by me, or something. It really should be putting it back on you and not be.
If you said that I was puzzled by you, could I deny? Could I deny that, or do I have to accept it?
You could. Well, you could just say you're lying to me, or you know what I mean. I
could flip it.
Rule breaker. That the more that people throw dogma at me, the more I fight against it. So for me, it's all about the presentness of our connection. Like what we have right now is exactly a model of that engagement.
So it's the goal or the objective of the exercise rather than strict adherence to a technique. Yeah.
Actually liberation from the technique.
So what about this other liberation from technique? So what about this other Meisner technique, which I've used and had some success with, where the actors are actually speaking their lines. So in a Shakespeare play, for example, but you say your line, whatever it might be, and I take a word, often the last word, but not necessarily, and I repeat it to you in a kind of questioning, or I just feed it back to you. It might be questioning, or it might be challenging, or it might be, you know, something. It shows that that's what stood out for me. That's impacting me in some way. I'm responding to that word. And then you repeat your line, either to affirm what you had already said. Maybe you change your operative word. But you respond to my response. But it stays, but it's all about hooking that back into that line.
Yeah. And you know, either confirming, like you said, confirming, yes, that's what I said, or no, you didn't quite get it.
Right.
And allowing the delivery to focus on, focus it in a different way, right?
Right.
The attention, the tactic,
sure.
The action of that delivery.
Or just bring it out more fully. So I like absolutely. That because that's a connecting. So much of Meisner is about that. It's about the connection, right? Between the two.
Yeah, that cycle between two people or more, right?
Yeah.
Honestly, and with Shakespeare too, the audience is always a character in the play too. And so it helps in terms of, and this goes back, this might sound a little woo-woo, but that energetic body, when that we strengthen, that we engage in yogic practice, that transference of energy only happens from an open heart, from an open third eye, Agnya chakra, right? We are projecting that energy out to the audience and receiving at the same time. So there's always a certain quarter, you're always at least a quarter open to that audience so that you're that energy and allowing there to be a three-way communication between you, the actor that you're on stage with, and the audience too. So I think Meisner, that mindset, actually opens us to a larger conversation with the audience, an unspoken one, as it were, an energetic, a vibrational connection, which is something that we acknowledge and then we discredit at the same time. We walk into a place, and especially as we do in prison, walk into a room, you're like, wow, the vibe is weird, or there's a bad vibe in here. My body is registering information. I'm articulating in a certain way. And then we look at it through a scientific lens. And, oh, that's balderdash. That doesn't exist. Right?
Yeah.
But I believe very fully from my experience that that energetic engagement is a primal understanding that we just discredit because we go head over body, right? But science is catching up, right? We know that there's 72,000 nerve endings in the viscera. In the area of the intestines and our guts, that there are more neurons in our enteric nervous system in our intestines than in our spinal cord, right? 80% of the neural traffic travels up from the belly to the brain. So it's the body telling the brain what's going on, not the other way around. So it's just an upsetting of certain traditional modes of knowing, I think. Descartes' error, as it were, right? That the mind rules the body. No, that's not how we evolved, you know?
So when you're in rehearsal and practice, training, performance, all of that stuff, you're reminding your actors of their third eye, for example, or their what's going on in their body.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, yesterday, and as we were saying before we started taping, I'm in my second class back at, I teach at Indiana's largest state prison, Westville Correctional Facility. And, you know, I'm teaching acting Shakespeare right now. I do a Kundalini yoga club. I teach acting process. I teach acting Shakespeare. This was my second class period, and it's one class period a week. So it's a 3-hour class.
Oof.
So it's big. Yeah. But I walked in there yesterday and we were, and I said, let's get to know each other in a different way. And we stood in a circle, connected to the breath. And I started talking about the magnetism of energy, and how we can kind of start this little quote unquote bonfire in the middle of our circle, where we can lay our best intentions about how we're going to support each other in the process. And I had them throwing values out. What are the values of this circle?
Oh, nice.
What are our intentions? You know, support, humility, success, risk, love. You know, these are the things that the guys are throwing into the middle of that. And you just feel this engagement growing and growing, this openness of the energy growing and growing and growing. And you know you're on the right track, because then that's a space, because I said this is the space where we'll be performing. So what is the, what's the fragrance that we want to leave in the center of that space, so that each one of us feels like a scaffolding of success around them? And yes, really excited. I got like 16 guys this semester, and I feel like I've got the most engaged group ever. Because, you know, I walked in and some of them, like two of them had their monologues memorized, and I just gave it to them last week. So we're setting ourselves up for a really cool semester, I think.
And so do they work with those monologues through the semester, or how does it format it?
First half. So basically, monologue, first half, first eight weeks, scene, the second 8 weeks.
Nice.
I do find, you know, the scenes sometimes are a little bit hard to navigate because they don't have private space to rehearse. And so that becomes a, you know, an exercise of vulnerability in the general population.
Yes.
Where you got two guys trying to rehearse a Shakespeare scene.
Yeah.
But we've developed the culture enough, an appreciation of Shakespeare in performance. We're bringing what those guys say, color, into a colorless space. So they're actually starting to really appreciate it. But there's always the odd guy here or the odd guy there that is going to, you know, throw some insults at them and whatever. So I need to work on creating a more secure perimeter for them to be able to rehearse without that potential humiliation. I don't even think
there's a challenge.
Compromise of their safety in a way.
We could share stories about that, I'm sure. You know what, Scott? This is incredible, but we actually exhausted our time.
Wow.
And we ran right up against it, and you've been fantastic. This has been such a treat. I'm going to really enjoy listening to this recording, and I know our audience is going to derive a huge amount from it. So thank you so much for your time. This is Scott Jackson, the Executive Artistic Director of Shakespeare at Notre Dame, and my good friend, wonderful human being. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's a pleasure.